Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 20. The dynasty of Puru. So, just have a look at our family tree. So, Pururava had a son, Ayil. He had five sons. And we looked at those sons, and then Nahusha, one of those sons of Ayil, had six sons, and we looked at some of those, and Yayati. We looked at Yayati coming down, had five sons, of which we looked at the some of the members of the Yadu dynasty. And now we're going to look at another son of Yayati, is Puru. And of course, as we remember, the looking at Yadu, they come down to the Brijni dynasty. There are actually two Brijnis there. Coming down from Yadu to Brijni, we get Vasudeva, the father of Krishna, Balaram Subhadra, and others. And of course, Vasudeva had other brothers and sisters. And he had one of those sisters, of course, was Kunti, the mother of the Pandavas. And then we see that so Kunti. So then on the other side, of course, we looked at. So they were coming down from Yadu. Now, when we follow the line down through Puru, we come to the Kuru dynasty. From the Kuru dynasty, of course, we're going to come down to Dhritarashtra with Duryodhana. We're going to come down to Pandu with, who's... related to who was the husband of Kunti. And so therefore we see that the Pandavas are related to the Kuru dynasty through Pandu and Bhishma, going back to Santanu and Kuru. And they're also related to the Yadu dynasty through Kunti. They're related to Krishna's dynasty through their mother, and they're related to the Kuru dynasty through their father, Pandu. So So we're going to hear from the beginning about that Puri dynasty. Chapter 20, text number 1. Sri Kadavi Goswami said, O Maharaj Parikit, descendant of Maharaj Bharat, I shall now describe the dynasty of Puru in which you were born, in which many saintly kings appeared, and from which many dynasties of Brahmanas began. Prabhupada again mentions that, therefore, regardless of the family which one takes birth, when one is qualified with the symptoms of a particular section, he is to be described accordingly. One's place in the Varna divisions of society is determined according to one's symptoms or qualities. This is maintained everywhere in Shastra. Birth is a secondary consideration. The first consideration is one's qualities and activities. Text 2. King Janamajaya was born in this dynasty of Puru. Janamajaya's son was Pratinvan, and his son was Pravira. Thereafter, Pravira's son was Manusha. And from Manusha came a son named Charupada. The son of Charupada was Suju, and the son of Suju was Bahugava. Bahugava's son was Samyati. From Samyati came a son named Ahamyati, from whom Rudrasva was born. Rudrasva had 10 sons named Teyu, Kakshayu, Standaleyu, Kiteyuka, Jaleyu, Sanateyu, Dameyu, Sacheyu, Prateyu, and Vanayu. Of these 10 sons, Vanayu was the youngest. As the 10 senses, which are products of the universal life, act under the control of life, these 10 sons of Rudrasva acted under Rudrasva's full control. All of them were born of the Apsara named Kritachi. Ritayu had a son named Rantinava, who had 3 sons named Sumati, Dhruva, and Apratirath. Apratirath had only one son whose name was Kanva. So if we look at the picture showing the Puru dynasty, we have discussed 11 generations then coming down to the 12th, which would be Rantinava. And then Rantinava had 3 sons, Sumati, Dhruva, and Apratirath, who we've discussed. We've said that he had one son named Kanva. And so it appears that there were 2 Janamajayas in this dynasty, one at the beginning of the Puru dynasty and one comes way down towards the end after Parikshit Maharaj.
Are these names in the chart Puru?
In the chart it just says Puru, and then in brackets it says 11 generations.
Yeah.
And then we come down to Rantinava, who is mentioned here.
Yeah.
The son of Kanva was Medatithi, whose sons, all Brahmanas, were headed by Prashkana, the son of Ratinava named Sumati, had a son named Rabi. Maharaj Dushmanta is well known as the son of Rabi. So we've come down 12 generations, and then there were three sons. We've looked at two of those, and then in this line from Sumati, the dynasty goes quite a distance. And now this personality, Dushmanta. So once when King Dushmanta went to the forest to hunt and was very much fatigued, he approached the residence of Kanva Muni. There he saw a most beautiful woman who looked exactly like the goddess of fortune, and who sat there illuminating the entire ashram by her effulgence. The king was naturally attracted by her beauty, and therefore he approached her, accompanied by some of his soldiers, and spoke to her. Seeing the beautiful woman, the king was very much enlivened, and the fatigue of his hunting excursion was relieved. He was, of course, very much attracted because of lusty desires, and thus he inquired from her as follows, in a joking mood. "A beautiful lotus-eyed woman, who are you? Whose daughter are you? What purpose do you have in this solitary forest? Why are you staying here? O most beautiful one, it appears to my mind that you must be the daughter of a Kshatriya. Because I belong to the Puru dynasty, my mind never endeavours to enjoy anything irreligiously." So he's expressing his desire to marry Sukuntala. That's who this person is. Sukuntala said, "I am the daughter of Vishvamitra. My mother, Menaka, left me in the forest. O hero, the most powerful saint, Kanva Muni, knows all about this. Now let me know, how may I serve you?" Purport. Sukuntala informed Maharaj Dushmanta that although she never saw or knew her father or mother, Kanva Muni knew everything about her. And she had heard from him that she was the daughter of Vishvamitra, and that her mother was Menaka, who had left her in the forest. "O king, with eyes like the petals of a lotus, kindly come, sit down and accept whatever reception we can offer. We have a supply of nivara rice that you may kindly take, and if you so desire, stay here without hesitation." King Dushmanta replied, "O Sukuntala, with beautiful eyebrows, you have taken your birth in the family of the great saint Vishvamitra, and your reception is quite worthy of your family. Aside from this, the daughters of a king generally select their own husbands." As I mentioned in previous classes, that not all girls were arranged in the higher sections. They could choose their own husband in certain ways, and of course even in sections other than the Kshatriyas. Others may have done this as well in certain circumstances. So, so here it's in the purport. Thus, she indicated that she wanted Maharaj Dushmanta as her husband. As far as Dushmanta was concerned, he desired Sukuntala as his wife from the very beginning, as soon as he saw her. So the agreement to unite as husband and wife was natural. To induce Sukuntala to accept the marriage, Maharaj Dushmanta reminded her that, as the daughter of a king, she could select her husband in an open assembly. So others who did this were Sita Devi, Draupadi, and of course sometimes they have a competition if there's more than one suitor. It describes there are eight kinds of marriage, of which marriage by agreement is called the Gandharva marriage. Although marriage by personal selection or by agreement took place in the past, we find no such thing as divorce by disagreement. Of course, divorce by disagreement took place among low-class men. But marriage by agreement was found even in the highest classes, especially in the royal Kshatriya families. Maharaj Dushmanta's acceptance of Sukuntala as his wife was sanctioned by Vedic culture. How the marriage took place is described in the next verse. So it's even mentioned in the astrological shastras that, you know, we generally do a compatibility. But if there is a strong attraction between the man and the woman, amongst those who are qualified to be able to select their partners, you know, they can recognise that this person would be a good partner. Then no astrological compatibility is required. And that's a bona fide method. So they just meet, they know that they can recognise the good qualities and the good circumstances by which they met, and they just get married. So that's a bona fide method. So when Sukuntala responded to Maharaj Dushmanta's proposal with silence, the agreement was complete. Then the king, who knew the laws of marriage, immediately married her by chanting the Vedic pranab Omkara in accordance with the marriage ceremony as performed among the Gandharvas. Mentioned in the purport that religious principles are meant to invoke the blessings and mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, who says in Bhagavad Gita that he is personally present in sexual desires that are not contrary to religious principles. In our Krishna consciousness movement, we allow marriage on the basis of religious principles. The sexual combination of men and women as friends is irreligious and is not allowed. And of course, when Prabhupada, says friends, you know, meaning boyfriend, girlfriend, which is, Radharani and Krishna, of course, and Radharani, Krishna and the gopis. They were, you know, sometimes Prabhupada refers to them that they grew up as friends, you know, meaning boyfriend and girlfriend. King Dushmanta, who never discharged semen without a result, placed his semen at night in the womb of his queen, Sukuntala, and in the morning he returned to his palace. Thereafter, in due course of time, Sukuntala gave birth to a son. Now, You see. So, just this story of the birth of Sakuntala, that's mentioned in the Bhagavatam 4.24.12, that Vishvamitra, by hearing the tinkling of her hand bangles, you know, his transcendental meditation broke, and being attracted to Sakuntala, being attracted to Menaka, he fathered Sakuntala. So Vishvamitra was her father. And that Menaka, that's mentioned also in the Bhagavatam, that she was sent to delude Vishvamitra purposely. And so it was no accident that her tinkling of her hand bangles were meant to draw his attention. And so then, of course, when Menaka had the baby, she left both Vishvamitra and Sakuntala, and she returned back to the heavenly planets. And and as we've seen here, that Kanva Muni then found Sakuntala in the forest, and he raised her.
Who was that?
Kanva Muni.
Okay.
That's a bit of background about Sakuntala, how she ended up there. In the forest, Kanva Muni performed all the ritualistic ceremonies concerning the newborn child. Later, the boy became, so Dushmanta and Sakuntala, they've had a son, and Kanva Muni performs all the ritualistic ceremonies for the child, and later the boy became so powerful that he could capture a lion and play with it. Sakuntala, the best of beautiful women, along with her son, whose strength was insurmountable, and who was a partial expansion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, approached her husband Dushmanta. When the king refused to accept his wife and son, who were both irreproachable, an unembodied voice spoke from the sky as an omen and was heard by everyone present. Purport. Maharaj Dushmanta knew that Sakuntala and the boy were his own wife and son, but because they came from outside and were unknown to the citizens, he at first declined to accept them. Sakuntala, however, was so chaste that an omen from the sky declared the truth so that others could hear. When everyone heard from the omen that Sakuntala and her child were truly the king's wife and son, the king gladly accepted them. There's the transcendental voiceover. Still going on today. When people watch the TV and you get the voiceover. So this is the original version. The voice said, "O Maharaj Dushmanta, a son actually belongs to his father, whereas the mother is only a container, like the skin of a bellows. According to Vedic injunctions, the father is born as the son. Therefore, maintain your own son and do not insult Sakuntala." Right, so the father becomes the son. So the son is an expansion of the father. And the mother is simply a storekeeper in one sense. Because the seed of the child is placed in her womb, But it is the father who is responsible for maintaining the son. So that's the Vedic conception. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he is the seed-giving father of all living entities, aham bija pradapita, and therefore he is responsible for maintaining them. This is also confirmed in the Vedas, eko bahunam yo vidati kamam. Although God is one, he maintains all living entities with their necessities for life. And because the Father Krishna is fully opulent, there is no scarcity of food, and because there is no scarcity, the propaganda of overpopulation is only a myth. Actually, one suffers for want of food when material nature, under the order of the Father, refuses to supply him food. It is the living entity's position that determines whether food will be supplied or not. When a diseased person is forbidden to eat, this does not mean that there is a scarcity of food. Rather, the diseased person requires the treatment of not being supplied with food. So, you know, Prabhupada once asked his disciples, you know, why is it that amongst Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva, why is it that Vishnu is a maintainer? And the answer is, why is he the maintainer? Why not Brahma? Why not Shiva? Why not any of the other demigods?
He's the seed giving father.
He's the father. That's the father's business. That's why he's the maintainer. And Prabhupada said, you know, he gave the example that, you know, you can get someone to create a house for you, or perhaps you may demolish one and build another, but you don't ask someone else to come and raise your children. You know? So that's why Vishnu is the maintainer. Because only the father can do that. It's a very important point, you know, and that proves that he is God, not just a demigod. As well, you know, the very fact that he's the maintainer. You know, if you go into someone's house and you see a builder and a plumber and an electrician, and one gentleman looking after the kids, you'd assume that he's the father. Although these days you wouldn't know. So, but you know, here, you know, how, says here, King Dushmanta, who never discharged semen without a result, you know, so unless he desired a particular child, you know, he would not pass semen. That's brahmachari, even grihastha life. O King Dushmanta, he who discharges semen is the actual father, and his son saves him from the custody of Yamaraj. You are the actual procreator of this child. Indeed, Shakuntala is speaking the truth. And so, you know, there's a Vedic injunction here, and describing that because the son delivers his father from punishment in the hell called put, the son is called putra, the tra is like delivering. According to this principle, when there is a disagreement between the father and mother, it is the father, not the mother, who is delivered by the son. But if the wife is faithful and firmly adherent to her husband, when the father is delivered, the mother is also delivered. Consequently, there is no such thing as divorce in the Vedic literature. A wife is always trained to be chaste and faithful to her husband, for this helps her achieve deliverance from any abominable material condition. All right, so that Vedic verse clearly says the son saves his father from the custody of Yamaraj. It never says Putra Nayati Mataram. The son saves his mother. The seed-giving father is delivered, not the storekeeper mother. Consequently, husband and wife should not separate under any condition, for if they have a child whom they raise to be a Vaishnava, he can save both the father and mother from the custody of Yamaraj and punishment in hellish life. Any comments? What's that? Yes.
Because it's after the mother who takes care of the child. The affection in this thing comes from the mother. She takes on a lot of sacrifice, and a lot of this thing comes from the mother.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So obviously the arrangement there is made so that there won't be divorce, isn't it? It's
because divorce doesn't depend. I mean, two hands are required.
I heard Prabhu from one of the lectures. I can't remember that living entity is given one birth as male, another birth as female. But if this person doesn't go back in this birth, he will become a female. Then if he doesn't go again, male, like that. Normally, you know, to be fair, you know, the Krishna system is very fair. So when the woman becomes a man, she or he has to make use of that birth. Otherwise, they'll slip on to the female. Again, like that.
You know? You're saying alternate?
Alternate. Because typically, you know, a man will be thinking, unless he's a devotee, he's going to think of the wife most of the time. And at the death, you know, he's going to become a female.
So they gave a Vedic reference for that?
I heard from some lectures. I don't know. So it is, one birth male, one birth female. So I was just trying to think, probably, you know, if you can't make it in the female body, then the next birth you have to make it up.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't heard that reference. But overriding that would be, you know, what's there in the Gita, that, you know, according to one's consciousness at the time of leaving the body, that is the main principle. So,
but typically, if someone is not a devotee, they'll be engrossed in the materialistic life, and obviously, Prabhu, they're not going to. Their focus will be on each other, no, Prabhu. Welfare and all this stuff.
That may ordinarily be the way their consciousness, you know, the focus of their consciousness. That's right. But if their consciousness. If they don't have that particular attachment to their wife, they're not thinking, you know, so much attached to the wife or to women in general, then it's highly likely that, you know, if they're attached to those particular activities they perform as a male, you know, there are many, for instance, you know, many persons in... you know, a military sort of role, quite often, you know, they're out performing their military duties, they come home, they see the wife and children, and they go out and, you know, sometimes that type of lifestyle, they're more involved in what they're doing as a male more so than, you know, the wife. So it would depend on certain circumstances, but the overriding factor is, you know, what their consciousness is. Yeah. But as you say, if there is a general principle like that, then yes, they really have to take advantage of it. And also, if you know, the it's another incentive for those who take birth in the female body to take advantage of the protection of having a husband, you know, one husband, to be very chaste. You know, men have a tendency, as we've seen, that is mentioned in many places in these scriptures that Prabhupada describes, and the scriptures describe that. I think we read it in the Srimad Bhagavatam the other day, Canto 4, chapter 25, text number 34, I think, in that purport. That, I think it was there, was something there, that, you know, men have a tendency to want to enjoy with many women. Many
more.
Was it yesterday, was it?
Thursday.
Right, yeah. So it was in that purport, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, many times Prabhupada mentions that. So to protect women, you know, because men have a tendency to try and seduce women, and as we've seen, even if they're already married, or even sometimes pregnant, or what have you, you know, men have a tendency to try and exploit them, and, you know, to be quite forceful in that way. And therefore, as an incentive for women not to, you know, become a victim of that, then they, you know, they know that if they remain with their husband as a chaste wife, and not allow themselves to be victimized by other men, then when the son performs the Shraddha ceremony, she'll be delivered along with her husband. Otherwise, if she's separated, she won't be. She doesn't get the benefit. Because we know that, you know, if... therefore, you know, all the more reason why in Kali Yuga that... The son should be a mother, because, you know, quite often most, you know, boys, you know, male children in this Kali Yuga, their mothers are divorced. They may have married several times. And then, you know, then there's a question of what happens if they don't have a son. What happens to the father?
Mm.
What happens to the mother? There's no son. So, you know, there is sort of a, you know, a succession list that, you know, if the elder son can't do it, then the next one might do it. Or, you know, an uncle, you know, the husband, this, you know, so different men go down the list. But because we don't follow Karma Kanda, then even if there's some discrepancies, that sometimes the women, you know, there's a daughter, you know, I've done ceremonies, there's only daughters, and they do the ceremony. I just get them to do that. And but because... you know, we're worshipping Krishna for his blessings. Then even if there's discrepancies like that, they still get the benefit because they're worshipping Krishna. You know, Krishna, you know, can override some of the, you know, material restrictions that ordinarily would be there.
But what you're saying is
They worship Krishna. They have prayed to Krishna, and whatever this material situation, Krishna will, you know, if there's a nice devotee, you know, performing that ceremony for them, you know, Krishna will, you know, make adjustments and not consider the material faults there, but just answer their prayers.
Yeah. So, I mean, they're whether it's a male or female, so long as they're following the bhakti
mark,
it doesn't depend on their
son. No. They just got to take shelter of a devotee priest. Yeah. But it goes to
show. Do they have to still take the shelter of the devotee priest, or even if they are doing devotional service and?
Oh yeah, they can do it themselves. What I'm saying is, if they're not a devotee, then they have to take shelter of a devotee priest to do that ceremony to get that benefit from Krishna.
I was thinking, you're talking about the shraddha ceremony, right?
Yeah.
So the person is dead. So a person, a devotee is dead.
No, not a devotee has died.
Suppose if a devotee has died, and according to this devotional service, he's going to be delivered. It has nothing to do with this children, that's what I'm saying. So there's no question of ceremony here.
Right. Therefore, I'm talking about when there is a need for a ceremony.
Okay, I came from from that, when you said that. I said this is following the Varnashram one dharma. So, but here now, if there is a devotee and he has been in devotional service, he passes away. We don't say that he passes away. So then Krishna directly takes care of him, whether the ceremony is done or not done.
That's right. But in the case where the person who passes away is not a devotee, and the person who needs to do the shraddha is not a devotee, then in many different aspects, the shraddha ceremony for the mother may not be fulfilled. You know, so if the parents have separated, then the mother's going to have some difficulty there. If there's no son, there's going to be some difficulty there. And then of course when they're performing the shraddha ceremony, if they're not offering Vishnu Prasad, or if the priest is not a Vaishnava, sometimes you might get a Mayavadi reading verses from the Gita or chanting prayers that Krishna considers an offender. There's very little benefit. And they may not be offering Vishnu Prasad, they may just be offering some demigod Prasad, or, you know, just what the person likes. So in Kali Yuga, you know, trying to deliver for the general mass of people, trying to deliver their parents, etc., by the shraddha ceremony, in many cases, is almost useless. In many cases, that's not going to save them from the sinful reactions that are coming their way. You know, if someone's been engaged in eating meat and, you know, so many different things, and someone, you know, assumes that by doing a shraddha ceremony, there's many, many discrepancies which are not, neutralized by the fact that someone is, you know, connected with Krishna through bhakti, then that's not going to deliver them from their sinful reactions. That's the point. Kali Yuga is like that, that there's a lot of religious principles. People are performing so many different religious principles. But there's really, there's so many discrepancies in what they're doing that there's really very little protection from them in the way of, you know, removing huge amounts of sinful activity, including the shraddha ceremony. Because So, you know, a lot of what happens in Kali Yuga, gradually, you know, there's a little bit of understanding, and then the next generation tends to imitate what they've seen without an understanding. Oh, I saw this done, you know, so I will do this. But they don't realise that the circumstances can be completely different, even though it appears to be exactly the same. You know, because they're unaware of the actual rules and regulations and how, you know, what does account in the karmic laws and what doesn't.
Putting the cat in the basket. Right?
Putting the cat in the basket really doesn't make a lot of difference, you know. As it describes here, you know, when verse 16, that, you know, Dushmanta, he married her by chanting the Vedic pranava Omkara. And the purport says, religious principles are meant to invoke the blessings and mercy of the personality of Godhead Krishna, who says in Bhagavad Gita that he is personally present, you know, in sexual desires and are not contrary to religious principles. So, so for instance, Dushmanta chanted Om to invoke the blessings and the mercy of the Lord. So it's not just a ritual, as Prabhupada puts it. You know, you're you know, trying to invoke that blessing. It's not automatic that you know, so and here Dushmanta, his determination is that I want to invoke the blessings of the Lord, and then according to the Lord's you know, rules and regulations, you know, engage in you know, sex with my wife to produce a child according to it. So that's his determination. So when he chants Om, he's preparing himself to perform an activity that's very pleasing to the Lord. Someone else may perform a religious ceremony and they're intending to do something sinful. You know, so you know, someone may go to the church and you know, but their determination within their heart is that, you know, yes, we get the blessings of God, we're going to have so much illicit sex. We don't really want a child. Perhaps if a child comes, we'll have an abortion. And how much mercy and blessings do you think the Lord will give when they perform that religious ceremony? So, you know, it's not just the ritual and the chanting. You know, the religious ceremony is invoking the blessings of the Lord. So, at one time, I had a couple and they said, we want to do a wedding just like my sister did. And, I said, okay. Well, and she said, they had their deities of Radha Krishna. And I said, yes, we can bring along the deities. And she said, we'll have them sitting behind us. And I said, oh, no, you can't sit with your back to the deities. Oh, no, no, but that's what they did. I said, but, you know, that's disrespectful. Mm. You know? And we discussed it over the course of weeks. They kept trying to, you know, no matter what I said. They eventually relented and put them to the side. But they kept, you know, forcing that issue. No, but they did it. So they were, you know, in their mind, they did it. They got the blessings. It's okay. And I was saying, no, you can't do that. You know, the whole idea is to get the blessings of the Lord. So you can't be disrespectful while trying to get blessings like that. So the Shraddha ceremony, in the same way, you know, we are trying to invoke the blessings of the Lord. It's not just the fact that the ritual is done. So, you know, where we leave out, Well, there's very significant discrepancies, and we're not particularly, you know, there really is a significant disregard. We're not asking the Lord. That's why whenever we do deity worship, you know, at the end of our puja, we ask the Lord, you know, if there's any discrepancies, anything left out, anything I should have done, which I haven't done, you please forgive me for that. Every time we do, you know, worship the deities, every time we perform a ceremony or samskara, we chant the same prayers, whatever that may have been left out, you please, like that. Because we're, you know, not that, well, you know, I've done a really good job, and therefore that's good enough. We never think like that.
So in the case of a devotee passing away, if their sons or whoever is supposed to perform Shraddha ceremony,
yes,
if, instead of doing that, if they just do, you know, Shravanam Kirtanam or devotional service,
yes,
on that particular day and seek blessings, is that good enough? Or, because not in every place we may have access to devotee priest who understands the process and the rituals.
Yeah, so basically, Prabhupada mentions that here in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1, text 41. It says, Arjun said, an increase of unwanted population certainly causes hellish life both for the family and for those who destroy the family tradition. The ancestors of such corrupt families fall down because the performances for offering them food and water are entirely stopped. Purport, according to the rules and regulations of fruitive activities, there is a need to offer periodical food and water to the forefathers of the family. So, of course, periodical means that, you know, quite often on the anniversary, the yearly anniversary, they may do it as well. And this offering is performed by worship of Vishnu because eating the remnants of food offered to Vishnu can deliver one from all kinds of sinful reactions. So, there we understand that... you know, the forefathers eat food offered to Vishnu to deliver them from sinful reactions. So, you know, what we're offering. Sometimes the forefathers may be suffering from various types of sinful reactions, and sometimes some of them cannot even acquire a gross material body and are forced to remain in subtle bodies as ghosts. Thus, when remnants of prasadam food are offered to the forefathers by descendants, the forefathers are released from ghostly or other kinds of miserable life. Such help rendered to forefathers is a family tradition, and those who are not in devotional life are required to perform such rituals. So there Prabhupada says there, if they're not in devotional life, they're required. One who is engaged in devotional life is not required to perform such actions. Simply by performing devotional service, one can deliver hundreds and thousands of forefathers from all kinds of miseries. Hundreds, just by... So, and then Prabhupada quotes that verse from Bhagavatam 11.5.41. Anyone who has taken shelter of the lotus feet of Mukunda, the giver of liberation, giving up all kinds of obligation, and has taken to the path in all seriousness, owes neither duties nor obligations to the demigods, sages, general living entities, family members, humankind, or forefathers. Such obligations are automatically fulfilled by performance of devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Which verse is that from?
Text 41, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1.
1.41. Yep. So, if this is the case, then... what is the meaning of this eighth offense when we say quoting devotional service with ritualistic activities? Like, the purpose here is to give something to the departed soul when we're doing devotional service. Is that an offense or what's that?
whenever we chant Hare Krishna, we only perform, you know, any devotional activities such as samskaras. Our purpose is only to please Krishna by helping a person to progress in their attachment to Krishna. So we really only have one purpose. That, you know, if somehow or another, whatever activity we're doing helps them to think of Krishna, chant Krishna, take prasadam, hear the Gita, and that way develop some faith and attachment to Krishna, then we perform that any activity in devotional service for that purpose, because Krishna wants that. He said that very clearly in the Gita. But those who preach this message are very, very dear to me, and they guarantee pure devotional service. So none of those, whenever we have that motivation, then we're guaranteed that we're in the path of pure devotional service and we're not committing offences. Others who we're performing the ceremony for, they may have all sorts of motivations, but we don't take them on. You know, they pray for all sorts of things. At the same time, Krishna accommodates those persons too as well. In the Bhagavad Gita, he says that four types of persons render service unto me. They're all magnanimous souls. You know, they're also dear to Krishna, because instead of going to demigods, they're coming to Krishna. And, as the father. So keeping their relationship with Krishna, so he likes that. And therefore, he, fulfills their material desires as well. The Bhagavad Gita says, even if one has material desires, still they should approach Krishna. So we don't discourage people from approaching Krishna with material desires. You know, we try and encourage them to advance past that stage and teach them about... But if they can't be encouraged at that stage, or then we try to, encourage them, yes. Even if you have particular desires, better take shelter of Krishna than demigods, which is a waste of time, a useless waste of time, really, especially in Kali Yuga. But even we're encouraging people, they're coming for the fulfillment of, particular material desires. So, for instance, I was in the corridor the other day, I was in the Jaggi room, and there was a group came from MYOB or something. It's like an accounting sort of a thing. And they were students, some Westerners, some Asian, one Indian amongst them, and the teacher, who was a Westerner. I was in there just preparing something, and I think Sukadev was looking after them. But as they were coming down the stairs, one manager yelled out, I don't know who it was, because she said, get them to say hello to Gangeshwar.
Get them to say hello to Gangeshwar.
I didn't see who it was, but anyway, so I went out there to say hello, and I spoke to them near the stairwell then, and we had a nice chat. But the first thing I said to them was, what made you come to the Hare Krishna temple?
Mm.
And they said, it's related to our, MYOB accounting, software package. And I said, so, your economic studies brought you to Krishna. And they laughed because they understood, you know, well, yeah, it actually did, you know. It was, you know, they understood, you know, it was quite funny, you know, of all the reasons you go to a spiritual temple, you know, it's a, you know, it's because of our... So even they could see that, you know, the light side of that. But, you know, we wouldn't make them feel bad about it, that, you know, you know, this is a holy place, you know, why are you coming, you know? We want them to come, even out of curiosity, which is a material reason in that sense. So, but we're not engaging in karma kanda by encouraging that, because, you know, our goal is always the same, is that, you know, so they come along, we want them to somehow think nicely of Krishna, and they, if they think anything nice about the Hare Krishna temple, about Prabhupada, about the devotees, about Prasadam, about the people they met there, one nice thought and they've done devotional service. They did so much devotional service. So, yeah. So, no, we're not... but we have to be careful because, you know, it's very easy. So, in other words, I have been, you know, labelled by devotees who don't know what I'm doing, that I am performing karma kanda and even demigod worship and things like that. So externally it looks like that. And the danger is that, you know, devotees see that they may want to take it up as a business, or they may actually literally be utilizing the holy name of the Lord for their material purposes, as if that's okay, without actually, you know, having a proper preaching mood themselves. You see, so then those devotees doing the same thing, then they actually can be causing all sorts of namaparads, and that's what I say by imitation. It's a surprise how the exact same thing can be completely different. One can have a spiritual result and one can be, you know, be causing all sorts of troubles, even though it appears to be the same. It comes down to consciousness.
Mm. One point, thought, in Mayapur, in the Mayapur Academy, Bhakti Vidyavarna Maharaj was invited to speak to those who are learning in the Yagya and everything.
Mm.
So there are many students there. The first statement Maharaj made was, if you think by learning yagya and you can make money out of it,
yeah.
if that is in your consciousness, that's the first sentence he said.
Yeah.
If that's in your consciousness, you will be burned by karma and you will fall down from devotional service,
yeah,
pretty much in a few months.
That's right. Yeah.
And if that is the aim, please leave the class now.
That's right, yeah.
That is the first statement.
Yeah. And, you know, so it's... So it's not just devotees that, you know, because who may be attracted for the wrong reasons to such things, but sometimes management also, you know, may just not quite understand that, oh, well, anyone can put a bit of ghee in the fire like that, and they can put that devotee into jeopardy, you know.
Yeah.
It is mentioned, I think it's somewhere in the 8th canto, you know, perhaps to do a Sukracharya, but, you know, when you perform yagyas or ceremonies, you know, for anyone, you always have to accept a certain amount of reaction.
Mm.
You know, each and every ceremony, you get a certain amount of karmic reaction. You must, like that.
Mm.
Yeah, we read that in the previous... and therefore... And the guru also, every time they accept a disciple, you know, they have to accept a certain amount. Because, you know, Krishna, if he chooses to, he will protect that devotee from that karmic reaction. But even we see, you know, just to show us, we may see even Prabhupada suffering the reactions of, you know, accepting disciples, Krishna just showing us and is giving a little, you know, tinge. But So one has to be very careful, but it depends. One has to understand that, you know, Krishna's protecting the devotee from that by removing some, not all, of that karmic reaction. Mm. Yeah, there was a taxi driver who came and did a ceremony with me once, and I went to his house as well, did a ceremony, and he said to me, "Oh, you know, I'm going to do that too. You know, I can do that." And I explained to him that at that one point, I said, "You know, I take a little bit of your karma, and every time you do that," he said, "Really?" I said, "Yes." And he just completely stopped. He understood. I said, I only had to mention it. He said, "No, that's it. Not touching it." Otherwise, he thought, yeah, this is, you know, a little business on the side, be good. You know, another thing where devotees have to be careful is where... you know, they a devotee may you know, that perhaps even they understand the proper preaching mood that they should have, but in doing you know, that type of service, they actually their interactions with other devotees doing that, you know, is somewhat offensive. Then Krishna, again, even though they have the preaching mood, then Krishna again may say that no, I'm not going to take those reactions. You know, so for instance, say if you're at Mayapur, where you may have 10-20 devotees, they know, okay, we have to actually have a proper preaching mood and, you know, not to commit any, you know, the eighth offence of the holy name, you know, of the Lord. But their interactions, because sometimes devotees get very competitive, you know, who's the top dog, you know, who's superior, and you know, different, and therefore they can get a bit, you know, in that overzealous mood, that, you know, a little bit envious, jealous. Then Krishna also would, you know, so, you know, there's a fruit of mentality there that's causing this, you know, envious nature. So then again, they can suffer the results of the of accepting that. And you know, even in one ceremony or one disciple, there is so much karmic reaction, it's not, you know, it's not to be played with. So much karma. There's one, you know, in Kali Yuga, you take the smallest percentage of someone's karma, that's not to be played with.
Yeah. But generally gurus, they suffer because of the disciples.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
just by accepting that act.
Yeah. Krishna removes the karma, but, you know, you can see that you know, Krishna always just leaves a little bit. It's almost like a warning, you know. Really think twice about taking this position as guru, because, you know, you make sure that you're fixed up, because you're playing with fire at that. It's a very, very serious thing. You know, if there's the slightest, you know, desire to be sitting on the big asana, and you know and there's some desire for profit, adoration, distinction, very dangerous. As soon as there's that little fruit of mentality, so Krishna leaves a little bit just to show, you know, how even, you know, even really good pure-hearted devotees are still the difficulties that they have to accept by taking what to speak as if you're not on that platform. So it's a warning. Natural safeguard that protects the process from being taken over by materialists. You know, people cannot impinge upon Krishna's process. So Sukadeva Goswami said, when Maharaj Dushmanta passed away from this earth, his son became the emperor of the world, the proprietor of the seven islands. He is referred to as a partial representation of the Supreme Person of Godhead in this world. That is, we're going to hear about his son, Bharat. Bharat. And Prabhupada quotes that verse, Bhagavad Gita 10:41. Yad yad vibhuti mat sattvam shrimad urjitam eva va tad tad eva avagacchatvam mamate jamsa sambhavam. Anyone extraordinarily powerful must be considered a partial representation of the opulence of the Supreme Godhead. Therefore, when the son of Maharaj Dushmanta became the emperor of the entire world, he was celebrated in this world. So, you know, to this day, of course, you know, when we hear that someone is the emperor of the entire world, you know, you look at personalities like Caesar and, you know, the Roman, you know, rulers and Napoleon, you know, Hitler and Donald Trump. But, you know, to rule without a problem, you know, almost like easily, you know, seamlessly, the entire world, very, very rare, you know, in this world, because there's just so much, you know, everyone, you know, has that mentality, you know, I should be the lord of, you know, all, I suppose. So, you know, quite extraordinary. In the Bhagavatam, of course, we hear about many such personalities. We can almost become blasé about it, but very, very extraordinary. Even just to rule one country for a short amount of time, where people are happy, you know, very, you know, you look at even at the end of Dwapara Yuga, where you've got the, you know, and Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana and the Pandavas, you know, very, and so many qualified persons, so many sadhus there. Look at the problem, the difficulty there, what to speak of Kali Yuga. So, you know, they're quite extraordinary. Maharaj Bharat, the son of Dushmanta, had the mark of Lord Krishna's disc on the palm of his right hand. And he had the mark of a lotus whirl on the soles of his feet. By worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a grand ritualistic ceremony, he became the emperor and master of the entire world. Then, under the priesthood of Mamateya Bhrigumuni, he performed 55 horse sacrifices on the bank of the Ganges, beginning from its mouth and ending at its source, and 78 horse sacrifices on the bank of the Jamuna, beginning from the confluence of Prayag and ending at the source. He established the sacrificial fire on an excellent site, and he distributed great wealth to the Brahmanas. Indeed, he distributed so many cows that each of thousands of Brahmanas had one budva, 13,084, as his share. Report. As indicated here by the words Dushmante Agni Sachi Gune Chidaha, Bharat, the son of Maharaj Dushmanta, arranged for many ritualistic ceremonies all over the world, especially all over India on the banks of the Ganges and Jamuna, from the mouth to the source, and all such sacrifices were performed in very distinguished places. It's stated in Bhagavad Gita 3.9, Jagatak Kamano, Nyacha Loko Yam Kama Bandana. Work done as sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed, otherwise work binds one to this material world. Everyone should engage in the performance of Jagya, and the sacrificial fire should be ignited everywhere, the entire purpose being to make people happy, prosperous, and progressive in spiritual life. And so you see here, you know, this is within the realms of serving Krishna, that if you know, the dependents should be happy, prosperous, that's, and progressive in spiritual life. That's all within the realms of serving Krishna. Not that they're, you know, we're making them progressive in spiritual life and no one is happy. Or our grihasthas, you know, we're engaging them in spiritual life to the point where they can't earn a living. You know, all three, very, very nice statement. And that's Jagya. Of course, these things were possible before the beginning of Kali Yuga because they were qualified brahmanas who could perform such jagyas. For the present, however, the Brahma Vaivata Purana enjoins, in this age of Kali, five acts are forbidden: offering a horse in sacrifice, offering a cow in sacrifice except in the order of sannyas, offering oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and begetting children in the wife of one's brother. In this age, such jagyas as the Ashvamedha jagya, that'll be the horse one, and the Gomedha jagya, and the cow jagya, are impossible to perform because there are neither sufficient rituals nor qualified brahmanas. This verse says, Mamateyam Purodaya. Maharaj Bharat engaged the son of Mamata, Brigamuni, to take charge of performing this jagya. Now, however, such brahmanas are impossible to be found. Therefore, the Shastras enjoin, recommend those who are intelligent should perform the Sankirtan Jagya inaugurated by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Jagya must be performed, for otherwise people will be entangled in sinful activities and will suffer immensely. And of course, you know, many of the activities that we performed, even distributing prasadam, that's Jagya. You know, many of the things that we would do through fire jagya, we do through deity worship. And part of it is, you know, we know that by distributing prasadam, it purifies people of sinful reactions, and that allows them to gradually live more peacefully and have therefore more opportunity to also, because their material lives are becoming, you know, more stable, it allows them to take advantage of the spiritual opportunities of the Sankirtan movement as well. But that's not karma kanda, you know, that, you know, helping them to become liberated from their sinful reactions, you know, and helping them to become purified of it. That's not karma kanda for us, because our purpose is that we're trying to bring them to the point where we can preach to them in a purified state. If we were just doing it to remove their karma, that may be, you know, a material sort of a function. It really has to be, you know, the end game, whether we're helping them materially or, you know, through moving, you know, through on the path of liberation to gradually bring them to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, the Krishna consciousness movement has taken charge of introducing the chanting of Hare Krishna all over the world. This Hare Krishna movement is also jagya, but without the difficulties involved in securing paraphernalia and qualified brahmanas. This congregational chanting can be performed anywhere and everywhere. If people somehow or another assemble together and are induced to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, all the purposes of jagya will be fulfilled. The first purpose is that there must be sufficient rain, for without rain there cannot be any produce. All our necessities can be produced simply by rainfall, and the earth is the original source of all necessities. In conclusion, therefore, in this age of Kali, people all over the world should refrain from the four principles of sinful life and in a pure state of existence should perform the simple jagya of chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Then the earth will certainly produce all the necessities of life, and people will be happy economically, politically, socially, religiously, and culturally. Everything will be in proper order. So, you know, here, you know, Prabhupada is, you know, saying that, you know, we can help the populations of the world to enjoy material prosperity where there's sufficient rains, sufficient produce, and that is, you know, that is a very conducive to then them taking shelter for spiritual instruction from the Hare Krishna movement as well. So again, that's not karma, that's not engaged in, you know, material activities. If, so for instance, you know, if we perform ceremonies, say samskaras, you really want that, you know, what the purpose that people come for, you know, to have a, you know, give birth to a child, you know, the children become successful in their education. You really want their, you know, you do the ceremony, you actually want them to get some success in their education, or, you know, the house to go up without too many obstacles, or, you know, they get the job thereafter. Because if all your ceremonies are useless, you know, and then you try to give them some spiritual instruction, they're really going to have no faith in Krishna at all. You know, so if you know, if you actually doing, you know, we're chanting, and you know, it's like the drought. Can you imagine if we go out and chant Hare Krishna? Now Australia is burning, they're burning all over the world. We go out and chant Hare Krishna, we start getting rain. They know it's because they chanted Hare Krishna. People would be flocking to the temple. Tell us more. If we say, oh, you know, chant Hare Krishna, do yoga, there'll be rain, there's nothing. It gets worse.
Mm.
You know, they'll throw rocks at us.
Really? True. Mm. So, if the yoga is being done by non-devotees, does it work? Because Kali Yuga, we know the qualifications of the brahmanas, they are not really brahmanas according to the Vedic standards. And at the same time, they don't have protection of chanting or the spiritual prowess because they don't chant Hare Krishna.
Mm.
So how far is their sacrifices potent?
Yeah. Yeah, there must be some degree of faith in Vishnu or Krishna, so that even if they're worshipping the demigods, there has to be some degree of, you know, faith there, for there to be any result. And but there is in general, you know, and then those persons, they would have to also be, you know, the amount of piety in their lives has to be more than the amount of sinful activity.
Mm-hmm.
Because even if there's some result from their prayers, if their sinful life is considerable, it will just nullify a result. It will, you know, they may get the benediction and then it just get taken away anyway. Quite often that's the case. So there are a lot of different factors, you know, apart from just the, you know, they're worshipping the different demigods. But there's a little because at least you know, to some degree, you know, at least there may be a little faith in the Vedas. You know, there's some. So wherever there's some little faith in what is proper, then there may be enough result to just encourage that faith, but not necessarily, you know, enough result to stand on that platform alone, you know. That so there may be a little, but you know. So again, you know, if someone is showing, you know, some faith in the Shastras and some faith in higher authorities, you know, there's always a benefit in that.
Mm.
And then, you know, there's always a little reward, you know, for... If someone's... And again, if their life is reasonably pious... Not eating, you know, meat and, you know, so many different things, then, you know, they may be able to notice those benefits.
Mm.
That, you know, yes, there's a, you know, a definite improvement, you know, wealth, this, that, or the other. You know, for a very diseased person, sometimes even when the doctor understands they're making a little progress, they may feel that they're going backwards, you know. So for a very sinful person, even if they're getting a little benefit, they probably can't tell, you know. They may not think anything is coming. So if they're quite pious by nature, which is very rare, then yes, they may notice some things like that, because as Krishna says in the Gita, he does encourage it, but he certainly doesn't... what happens there, of course, is that in Kali Yuga, because Krishna wants them to take part in the Sankirtan, if they have a tendency to worship the demigods, and they do notice that by that pious activity and acknowledging high authorities, they actually got some result, Krishna can then utilize that. Then, okay, you've got a little faith. Now we'll introduce you to some devotees who can understand this more, or something easier, or something that adds a spiritual. So, you know, Krishna may utilize that rather than discourage it and discourage that like that. So... that verse in the is it the seventh chapter? No, it was a seven or nine. Let me get those two mixed up. Yeah, so, you know, he says in verse 20, those whose intelligence has been stolen by material desires surrender unto the demigods and follow the particular rules and regulations of worship according to their own natures. I am in everyone's heart as a super soul. As soon as one desires to worship some demigod, I make his faith steady so that he can devote himself to that particular deity. Now, you know, Prabhupada mentions that... one can neither have faith in the deity, you know, or a particular demigod without Krishna's sanction, and neither can a demigod attract followers without Krishna's sanction. They have no power if Krishna doesn't know like that. Therefore, because Krishna is attracting one to the Sankirtan movement, even the demigods themselves cannot make that an attractive process in Kali Yuga. Even they have no power to do that. Nor does Krishna, you know, sanction people developing that faith, unless he feels that somehow, for some, it may be advantageous, and he will, and they may get a result at that.
So that result, it is within their karma, or it is beyond their karma?
It is. I was listening to a lecture the other day that. By Prabhupada, and you know, he was saying that, you know, it's a little extra, you know,
yeah.
It's a little extra, yeah. If it was just within the karma, sort of hardly any benefit there, you know. It's sort of, you know, if the karma, you know, if someone's karma is that they're going to get exactly this, and then they go to so much trouble to worship the demigods, and you know. So, you know, from what Prabhupada said when I heard this lecture, and it was the first time I'd heard it, and when I heard what he said, can't remember the exact words, but that it's a little extra than their karma. According to their destiny, they get a little extra because they're worshiping the demigods. And that's sort of how he put it. So, as the first time I'd ever, you know, I've been looking for that statement for a long time.
It'd be nice to see the reference.
Yeah, it was in, so it's the Bhagavad Gita lecture.
Mm.
I'll try and, you know, try and remember it, because I always wondered the same thing. And when he said the statement, I went, you know, I was driving, I went, yes, that's it, Prabhupada said it, you know, that it's extra above your karma, like that, yeah. So which makes a lot of sense to me. He gave an example. I can't remember exactly what it is, but definitely that's what I got from Prabhupada. Yeah. And here it says, some may ask why the all-powerful God gives facilities to the living entities for enjoying this material world and so lets them fall into the trap of illusory energy. The answer is that the Supreme Lord, as Super Soul, does not give such facilities. If he does not give such facilities, then there is no meaning to independence. But, you know, he says, ultimately, he wants them to give that up and all those engagements and surrender unto him. And here it says that both the living entities and the demigods are subordinate to the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the living entity cannot worship the demigod by his own desire, nor can the demigod bestow any benediction without the supreme will. So, you know, as it's describing here, that in the Vedic literature it is stated, the Supreme Personality of Godhead as Super Soul is also present within the heart of the demigod. Therefore, he arranges through the demigod to fulfill the desire of the living entity. But both the demigod and the living entity are dependent on the supreme will. They're not independent. Now, therefore, here we see that, you know, when they're worshipping the demigods, it comes back to the will of the Lord, not necessarily their destiny. If it was, so therefore, the demigods don't have the right to override their destiny, and nor can the the living entity by worshipping a demigod override his destiny. But here that Vedic mantra is saying that actually the whole principle of demigod worship therefore is under the principle that the Lord is in the heart of the demigod, and by his will, you know, if he says it, then that can override the karma of the living entity and allow the demigod to give a benediction which is beyond their karma. So that's right, yeah. So it's there, it's in that purport. That was verse 21 of the 7th chapter, and there's a Vedic statement right at the end.
Yeah.
And that shows that it puts it out of the hands of just karma. Mm-hmm. Surprising how much is there in the Gita, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So Bharat, the son of Maharaj Dushmanta, bound 3,300 horses for those sacrifices, and thus he astonished all other kings. He has surpassed even the opulence of the demigods, for he achieved the supreme spiritual master, Hari. Purport, one who achieves the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead certainly surpasses all material wealth, even that of the demigods and the heavenly planets. The achievement of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the most exalted achievement in life. The verse, Jayatam Sudaputta Pango, Mama Manda Mater Giti, Matsavasva Padambojo, Radhamadnamohano. When Maharaj Bharat performed the sacrifice known as Mashnada, or sacrifice in the place known as Mashnada, he gave in charity 14 lakhs of excellent elephants with white tusks and black bodies, completely covered with golden ornaments. Nice elephants, white tusks and black bodies. As one cannot approach the heavenly planets simply by the strength of his arms, or who can touch the heavenly planets with his hands, one cannot imitate the wonderful activities of Maharaj Bharat. No one could perform such activities in the past, nor will anyone be able to do so in the future. When Maharaj Bharat was on tour, he defeated or killed all the Kiratas, Hunas, Yavanas, Pundras, Kankas, Kashas, Shakas, and the kings who were opposed to the Vedic principles of Brahminical culture.
So this Bharat, the name of Bharatavarsha, it's not after this Bharat, the son of...
That's Shabda. Right, yeah, I don't think it's him. I think it's after the son of Rishabh. Yeah, and Prabhupada says, therefore, there's three Bharats.
Yeah.
There's Lord Ramchandra's brother. There's the son of Rishabh, who Bharatavarsha was named after. That's my understanding. And then there's just the son of Dushyanta. And then, of course, when Arjuna is described as our descendant of Bharata, then, you know...
That is this
person. This one here, yeah. That's the reference to this one. Yeah. And as you see, that, you know, as a ruler, anyone who... opposed the Vedic principles or Brahminical culture, he killed them. So many races here, so you know, all over the world. So therefore, addressing him as, you know, son of Bharat, you know, live up to your predecessor. You know, those who are opposed to, you know, these religious principles like Duryodhana and Dhritarashtra, they should also be killed. Formerly, after conquering the demigods, all the demons had taken shelter in the lower planetary system known as Rasatala, and had brought all the wives and daughters of the demigods there also. Maharaj Bharat, however, rescued all those women along with their associates from the clutches of the demons, and he returned them to the demigods. So his... you know, religious battles took him, you know, far and wide in the universe. Maharaj Bharat provided all necessities for his subjects, both on this earth and in the heavenly planets. For 27,000 years, he circulated his orders and distributed his soldiers in all directions. As ruler of the entire universe, Emperor Bharat had the opulences of a great kingdom and unconquerable soldiers. His sons and family had seemed to him to be his entire life, but finally he thought all of this was as an impediment to spiritual advancement, and therefore he ceased from enjoying it. Purport: Maharaj Bharat had incomparable opulence and sovereignty, soldiers, sons, daughters, and everything for material enjoyment. But when he realized that all such material opulences were useless for spiritual advancement, he retired from material enjoyment. The Vedic civilization enjoins that after a certain age, following in the footsteps of Maharaj Bharat, one should cease to enjoy material opulences and should take the order of Vanaprastha. O King Parikshit, Maharaj Bharat had three pleasing wives who were daughters of the king of Vidarbha. When all three of them bore children who did not resemble the king, these wives thought that he would consider them unfaithful queens and reject them, and therefore they killed their own sons. The king, his attempt for progeny frustrated in this way, performed a sacrifice named Marutstoma to get a son. The demigods, known as the Maruts, being fully satisfied with him, then presented him a son named Bharadvaja. When the demigod named Brihaspati was attracted by his brother's wife, Mamata, who at that time was pregnant, he desired to have sexual relations with her. The son within her womb forbid this, but Brihaspati cursed him and forcibly discharged semen into the womb of Mamata. Report: the sex impulse is so strong in this material world that even Brihaspati, who is supposed to be the priest of the demigods and a very learned scholar, wanted to have a sexual relationship with his brother's pregnant wife. This can happen even in the society of the higher demigods, so what to speak of human society? The sex impulse is so strong that it can agitate even a learned personality like Brihaspati. So, as we were discussing the other day, this section of the ninth canto, many, many examples. And of course, in the eighth canto, we had Sabari Muni. So we really do understand that for liberation, one has to properly engage in bhakti yoga. And of course, that's why we're almost at Krishna's smiling face, the tenth canto. So to hear that, we have to come to the position above that where lusty desires are not such an obstacle to us hearing the tenth canto pastimes, hearing and understanding them, I described in the Bhagavatam the other day about the pastime where Krishna intervenes so that we can hear. Did you hear that pastime in the class? That I'll say it again.
Yeah.
Basically, when Radharani and Krishna were going through the Vrindavan forest, and that famous pastime where Krishna and Radharani separated from the other gopis so they could go off and Radharani could be alone with Krishna. And then at some stage when Radharani was getting a little tired, she decided this day she'll jump up on Krishna's shoulders. And at that time Krishna heard the other gopis who were following their footsteps were about to... So he didn't want to be subject to criticism, so he disappeared. So that's when he disappeared, because Radharani fainted, almost died, and when the other gopis saw her, they were so shocked to see her in a state of separation due to love that they consoled her. Anyway, since that pastime, which is the essence of that very deep understanding of the loving pastime, spiritual loving affairs of Radha Krishna, devotees have come to that tree, which as far as I understand may still be there, and they've hear the different pastimes of Krishna to try and understand Krishna's very exalted pastimes. So anyway, at some stage, one very old lady came to that place and was grinding grains on a grinding stone that was there, and she used to do that to earn some money. So she was blind and so old she was almost sort of very, you couldn't really move her away. Anyway, she made, there was so much noise because they were right there hearing the pastimes of Krishna, you know, for all the devotees come from all around to hear in that sacred spot, that they just couldn't concentrate. And they sort of considered that, you know, it's not possible to move her, you know, and because of her age and, you know, invalidity. They didn't want to. They thought, we're just going to have to move, you know, from this sacred spot that's, you know, for as far back as they can remember, you know, people have come to associate with these pure devotional, you know, topics. So then Krishna, he didn't want that. No, you know, I want them to, you know, I don't want this sacred place. I want this very sacred place where Radharani and I, you know, where she experienced that separation, though. I want that to be the place where they're here. So Krishna appeared and gave that, he appeared before that old woman and gave her the spiritual ability to see his form. And he put his foot on her grinding stone and, you know, indicated that, you know, she was actually disturbing the Shravanam Kirtanam and Lila Smaranam. And she said to, you know, Krishna, in essence, that basically, she, it's difficult for her to go anywhere, and if she stopped, how would she, you know, live? And so Krishna pressed his foot into that grinding stone and left a permanent imprint of his foot. And he said to her that, you know, you don't have to grind, you know, any grains anymore, and you know, when you can be the custodian of this area. And when people come and they see my footprint there, they will opt for coins and you'll never have to worry again. So, so you know, in that pastime, Krishna indicated that the process of hearing and chanting properly in the proper association of the glories of the Lord, you know, leading up to understanding the, you know, that beautiful loving affairs of Radha Krishna, which, you know, destroy the, you know, last taints of material desire within one's heart. It is so important that he personally intervened. So, if devotees want to spend time in their lifetime, that yes, let me hear properly, in such a way that gradually I get to enter into those 10th canto pastimes. Krishna's letting, he let us know that pastime, he's going to make it possible by maintaining the devotees, both materially and spiritually. He'll make it possible. But my point also is that he can also intervene to stop any nuisance activities where that is going on, you know, like that. So this canto, of course, is the greatest enemy to the process of hearing and chanting about Krishna's pastimes. It's, you know, material desire making us unqualified to hear those pastimes. And this, you know, the ninth canto, liberation, is really just giving that big push to, you know, to be very fearful of, you know, having, you know, not really fully taking shelter of bhakti and the danger of taking shelter of bhakti but not to the point where it's sufficient to actually protect one from lusty desires. Really, one has to take shelter of Krishna and the topic. So, you know, so much transcendental knowledge has been gained leading right up to the, you know, ninth canto, that if a devotee situates themselves in the transcendental knowledge that, you know, we've all, you know, heard and meditated upon since the beginning, that protects one fully. And these pastimes are part of that protection, even these pastimes. But without, you know, actually taking advantage of that transcendental knowledge, one is open to material desires in the heart, preventing the progressive hearing and chanting of, you know, Krishna's 10th canto pastimes. So it's not, you know, so therefore it's, you know, it's not just a matter of book knowledge. One actually has to then take the knowledge and protect oneself. And that protection means that, yes, that, you know, I'm always going to see Krishna everywhere and try and connect all my activities with Krishna. And in that way, that keeps my mind and all my activities purified. And that that devotional engagement, you know, which is, what do you say, conducive to one's level of transcendental knowledge, allows one then to move on to the next level. Mm. So, you know, this ninth canto is almost like a test of that. Mm. You know, it's almost like a test of that. You know, and also warnings. that if you're not on that platform, how easy, you know, that don't take you know, material contamination lightly. Really take advantage of that transcendental knowledge. Like that. So we heard that you know, the king, in his attempt for progeny, frustrated in this way, performed a sacrifice named Marutstoma to get a son. And then the demigods, known as the Maruts, they presented him a son named Bharatbhaj. And now, here it's describing that, to get a little further understanding. When the demigod named Brihaspati was attracted by his brother's wife, Mamata, who at that time was pregnant, he desired to have sexual relations with her. The son within her womb forbid this, but Brihaspati cursed him and forcibly discharged semen into the womb of Mamata. Mamata very much feared being forsaken by her husband for giving birth to an illegitimate son, and therefore she considered giving up the child. But the demigod solved the problem by enunciating a name for the child. So, you know, in the purport describes here that the common word still used in Hindu society for such a son, you know, dogla, or, you know, illegitimate, refers to a son not begotten by the husband of his mother.
But didn't it say that she was already pregnant?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so what happens is that, you know, it says here that, well, we're going to hear. So, Brihaspati said to Mamata, "You foolish woman, although this child was born from the wife of one man, through the semen discharged by another, you should maintain him." Upon hearing this, Mamata replied, "O Brihaspati, you maintain him." After speaking in this way, Brihaspati and Mamata both left. Thus the child was known as Bharadvaja. So,
So only one child.
What's that?
Only one child.
Well, that child was named Bharatbhaja. Mm. So it says, Although encouraged by the demigods to maintain the child, Mamata considered him useless because of his illicit birth, and therefore she left him. Consequently, the demigods, known as the Maruts, maintained the child. And when Maharaj Bharat was disappointed for want of a child, this child was given to him as his son. So, now, you see in... as Prabhupada mentions, Bara, in the translation of verse 38, Bara Dvajam, just maintain Dvajam, although born of an illicit connection between two men.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Bara Dvajam. Right? So, the mother and Brihaspada are both saying, you maintain this, legitimate child, Bharat Bhajam. So that's how he got the name Bharat Bhaj. And he was actually maintained by the demigods, the Maruts. Mm. Yes.
This sort of thing was happening during...
not very often, but...
What can we say of today's generation? We can't blame them.
Let's not say too much.
even people like Brahaspati's that's how. Yeah. And how can we blame today's common public who are not even Krishna conscious?
Mm.
And where now... there is illicit sex and they don't want to take care of the child.
Mm.
We can't blame them.
Yeah, that's what Lord Nityananda basically was saying to Lord Chaitanya, that how do you punish them? Their lives are so sinful, and of course those sinful activities cause them so much misery, actually. Because so much unwanted children in the world cause havoc. And then there's no one to save them from the parents from going to hell.
But then a person like Brahaspati...
So they're dead. So in one sense, you can't punish them. Their lives are already hell. Their lives are worse than what you could punish them. If you're going to punish them, they're already suffering more than that continually. And practically they're, like... dead people, so therefore just try and deliver them, show mercy. Yeah. Okay.
But,
so, yeah.
Did not have any consequence for that behavior.
There's always consequences.
She was pregnant.
Yeah.
What type of consequence did he get for?
Well, one is that, it's been, that embarrassing situation is basically going to be heard throughout the universe in the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Puranas for all time to come. That's a very embarrassing situation. I mean, we're sitting here, Brihaspati is... up there in the heavenly planets, feeling very proud of his exalted position, and we're sitting here talking about him in an embarrassing way. So that's very, very, that's a lot of punishment, and that just goes on, forever, practically. So, that's a lot of punishment.
Why did he go to the hellish planets for that? When we talk about Nidhishan Maharaj, just for not telling the lie that Krishna said, he had it 1 second. So why did he go to hellish?
Because a very powerful person, well situated in all other ways, is not as affected by sinful reaction as others. who don't have that power and who are not as well situated in every other way constantly.
Isn't it in some way, I can't do both, but they said, a person in ignorance, if they commit a mistake, Yudhishthira Maharaj, I think where, they said Yudhishthira Maharaj Sabha, I mean, he gives different punishments. For a person who does it in ignorance, it's a mild punishment. But a person who does it with knowledge, there's a more severe punishment. Because you have been in knowledge and you have done it. So same thing, like, now we can say Brahmasuri, he may be powerful, but actually all his power should have been gone just by, because he has misused his power on a lady. A lady was pregnant, married to somebody else and pregnant. That is most, how low can we get?
Pretty
That's
low.
The lowest.
I'm sure you're quite upset about that.
I feel sometimes if Partial this is not punishable, then where is the equity? Where we say that Krishna, you know, I mean, we think that, you can be, we talk about demigods and all that. In fact, it's better not to be a demigod because you get distracted and all that, you're missing all that we hear. But here, Brahaspati, who is supposed to be doing devotional service here, he is a he is a guru of the demigods. And he is doing such an abominable act and he's not being punished. In fact, his punishment must be most severe. You can't be a guru and do this.
So, for instance, if just like we have these forest fires burning, and then the firemen are going out and saving thousands of lives, thousands of homes, I saw on the news the other day that one woman was saying that when they have forest fires, very significant, especially over a long period of time, that there's an increase in the domestic violence, including, the people being fighting the forest. And when they get home, they're in such a state that, that there's sometimes a little domestic abuse, reported and that. So, and at the same time, there's no excuse, but then they've been out risking their lives to save, so many people's homes and that. So sometimes people, they say, they try and put things in a place so it doesn't happen. Maybe, a little understanding in one sense of both sides, but they may not be inclined to punish such a person whose activities have been, the good has been, very, especially if they've been doing that for, their life, fighting fires and so there may be an odd discrepancy. So, you'd be very hesitant to just take that one fault and neglect the fact that the person's been, quite heroic and beneficial to so many people over the, that is the course of their life, doing things that no one else can do or would do, no one else can even do. So, there's especially if it's a one-off sort of thing, you'd be, there'd be some cautions to that person, and the person would probably feel very ashamed of what they've done, but if there were some repeated issues, certainly, but, a one-off event of
like
something.
Like not repeated issues.
Well, there are different injuries, so it may not be all the same injury. We have to look into that. But, you understand, you can't just nullify all of that, You know, I have seen, you know, in various cases where, you know, criminal acts have been committed, that even the victim themselves, understanding the person's general good qualities and activities in this world, and the rarity of such an occurrence, has actually been, you know, not wanted them to be, even the victim themselves. So, you know, these things are taken into account. You know, Brihas Pati was, you know, I doubt that you'll hear of other incidents. I don't know of other incidents where Brihas Pati is. You know, he's got a very good reputation generally. But, so, you know, it's probably the one-off. But you know, we learn different things. So a very powerful person of immense benefit to the entire universe doing something that no one else is qualified to do, you've really got to be careful when you take that person out of action. You know, remove Brihas Pati, then who fulfills that role? So,
I was hearing one lecture by Bhanu Maharaj.
Mm.
He was mentioning that these demigods are also devotees of the Lord.
Mm.
And sometimes these events take place, like in the case of Indra, Brahma, Brahaspati.
Mm.
But they are all basically under some plan of the Lord. It's not for us to judge why they have acted.
Mm. That's right. That, you know, yeah. Well, did you hear that, Nimala? Nimala Krishna? Yeah. So that Naveen was quoting a lecture by Bhanu Swami, you know, it came to my mind as well, that it's good to have that confirmation, because I was thinking the same things, but you know, it's, you don't want to give that as the reason.
Mm.
But it is part of the reason that some things are somewhat part of the Lord's plan. So in fact, what we see in this chapter, that even persons, you know, on the highest level of transcendental knowledge or yogic prowess, you know, are susceptible, in the case of, say, the most alluring women within the universe, such as Uvasi, who actually appeared, you know, from the energy of Narayana Rishi, and that, you know, these, you know, it's not possible for them without being fully dedicated to pure devotional service to actually control their senses all the time, fully. You know, there'd be some faltering, and the Lord, you know, shows that. You know, we're learning these things from. So that's, you know, part of the pastimes of the Lord is that, you know, it will be revealed to us that even the you know, and this will happen in every day of Brahma and in every Manu, these greatest, highest, most elevated personalities, if they're not on the platform of pure devotional service, they will falter due to, because sex life is, you know, it will catch every one of them, even up to, you know, Lord Shiva. Of course, that was Mohini incarnation. So, that, you know, these are part of the pastimes of the Lord. So then who will that person be? You know, that, so what will be the result of that? So then the Lord understands, well, if Brihas Pati is going to discharge semen and there's going to be a child, then that's a very significant child in this universe. So, you know, in that sense, the timing, where he fits into the, you know, you wouldn't expect such a person to appear in the lineage in Kali Yuga. You know, basically, you know, he's this Bharadvaj is there as one of the descendants. And, you know, and it's also very interesting that, you know, we see that, you know, Pandu, you know, he also, there was a curse, right, that you can't embrace your wife to have a child, otherwise you'll be killed. And, you know, you always think to yourself, then, you know, how did that happen to Pandu? So, again, we understand the, you know, the will of the Lord, that the Pandavas would be, you know, born in another way, not through. That's part of the Lord's plan. But then, you know, we may not be too harsh on Pandu when we see that even such personalities like Brihaspati also, you know, succumb to the same influence. You know, it's that. So, you know, there are many different reasons that the Lord takes into account that when such a great personality is going to stumble, it will be within the plan of the Lord. As part, as you know, it's a little bit coordinated with, you know, the significant events of the Lord, you know, and for the purification of Brihaspati and for the purification of all of us, yeah. So, you know, there's a lot to it. There's a lot to it, yeah. And Brihaspati, he's the, you know, the Lord of Jupiter, isn't it? The, you know, so when you worship Jupiter, Brihaspati is that demigod who presides over the you know, the good karma and the religiosity given. So we read before that, you know, the demigods, you know, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Lord, including the demigods, of which Brihaspati is one. You know, but a demigod with, you know, great transcendental knowledge. but their much of their activities, there's a certain amount of destiny to them. Just as, you know, we what to speak of Brihaspati, we're reading that, you know, in the line of Ikshvaku, so many kings come and they come right down to a certain point in Kali Yuga, you know, and you know, their destiny is that, not that they're just born at a certain time, they will be kings and they will rule over certain significant empires that are, you know, astonishing, that other people can't do. So, you know, there's so much, you know, even they're taking birth in the Kali Yuga, and you can see there's a very significant amount of destiny along with their free will. So, you know, what to speak of personalities like Brihaspati, you know. So definitely in all of these personalities, all the demigods, all these personalities, there is an element of destiny there. And so we have to be, we have to factor that in as well. Mm. I was hearing about Bolivar, who Bolivia is named after. Anyone know Bolivar? Who is it? No.
What is it?
Bolivia in Latin America was named after Bolivar. And he, basically the Spanish ruled Latin America for about 300 years.
Mm.
And, you know, there was slave trade and a lot of atrocities, a very ruthless rule. And if there was any insurgents, you know, they just killed women and children in the marketplace and cut their heads off so that people, you know, wouldn't even think about it. You know, it's very...
Insurgent?
What's that?
What is that, insurgent?
Insurgents?
Mm-hmm. Did you say if there was any
insurgency?
What is that?
You know, uprising. And... but he actually single-handedly, you know, he had to gather armies, and they were known as the bare-shirted armies. In other words, so many of the army was so poverty-stricken, there was no uniform, so they had a bottom cloth, not even a top cloth. And in some parts of the war, he had to cross the mountains, huge, you know, mountains full of ice and snow. And they did that without shoes, And he gathered this army and fighting against odds that were, you know, 10, 20, 30 times greater than his, fully equipped with armor and weapons, and they've got theirs, you know, handmade spears and things like that, and he drove them, you know, the entire Spanish, every last one out of Latin America like that. And at the last part, he was so ill because, you know, the toll of just traveling, you know, thousands of miles and fighting. He died when he was about 49 or something like that, but he had, I think, tuberculosis or something. He was so ill that he was struggling to even ride a horse. And he had one last battle. And in that battle, the Spanish had about 18,000 soldiers, and he had about 5 ill-equipped, and they'd barricaded themselves into these hills and that, so that, you know, and they'd been there for a considerable amount of time, so he had no real chance of defeating them. And at that particular time, somehow they began to fight against each other, and he heard about it. And that allowed them, they snuck in the middle of the night and absolutely demolished half of them, and then on another day went back and destroyed a lot of them who were all demoralized by it. So you could see the arrangement of the Lord, you know. You know, when I heard hearing that history, you know, that was something, what are the chances? You don't have an army, you don't have proper weapons, you're too sick to practically ride your horse. It's the last battle, the last war. The odds had never been greater. And by that arrangement, he wins it. You know, if that arrangement wasn't there, it would never have happened. You'd never even hear his name. So, but you can see, you know, so they named Bolivia after this Bolivar. A very, very powerful personality. But, you know, striving to make all people equal, you know, black, white, native, like that, women, like that. And his partner was considered one of the, she's very famous for, you know, fighting for women's rights. So, but you can see that even down into Kali Yuga, there's a certain amount of destiny in these, you know, very, very powerful personalities that appear. What to speak of personalities, like, you know, British Putty. So that has to be taken into account. But also, you know, very, very powerful. You know, quite often Prabhupada, you know, his first answer is that very, very powerful persons, they are in a position where even there is some significant fault or sometimes a simple activity, it doesn't affect them to the degree that another person would affect. So therefore, if someone says, oh, Brihaspati did it, and some Kali Yugaite thinks, oh, okay, good enough for me, I'm going down that track, they won't recover from such an activity. It would decimate their life for generations to come. And the sinful reaction they will suffer. So it's not advisable to imitate powerful people, even when they've made some mistake. So, Sukadeva Goswami said, we read that. No. Sukadeva Goswami said, because Bharadvaj was delivered by the Marut demigods, he was known as Bitala, The son of Vitata was Manu, and from Manu came 5 sons, Brihachatra, Jaya, Mahavirya, Nara, and Gaga. Of these 5, the one known as Nara had a son named Sankriti. Right? So we're following down this line in the Puru dynasty, and we come down about 12 generations to Runtinava, who had 3 sons. We heard about 2 of them, very short dynasties, and then we're following Sumati, and now we've come down to... He's got 5 sons, and gradually what we will see is it's this will branch off into the Kuru dynasty. So the descendant of and this Gaga, we'll hear more about him anyway. Amaro's descendant of Pandit Sankriti had two sons. Named Guru and Rantidev. Rantidev is famous in both this world and the next, for he is glorified not only in human society but also in the society of the demigods. Rantidev never endeavoured to earn anything. He would enjoy whatever he got by the arrangement of providence, but when guests came, he would give them everything. Thus he underwent considerable suffering, along with the members of his family. Indeed, he and his family members shivered for want of food and water, yet Rantideva always remained sober. Once, after fasting for 48 days in the morning, Rantideva received some water and some foodstuff made of milk and ghee. But when he and his family were about to eat, a Brahmana guest arrived. Because Rantideva perceived the presence of the Supreme Godhead in everywhere and in every living entity, he received the guest with faith and respect and gave him a share of the food. The Brahmana guest ate his share and then went away. Thereafter, having divided the remaining food with his relatives, Rantideva was just about to eat his own share when a Sudra guest arrived. Seeing the Sudra in relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, King Rantidev gave him also a share of food. When the Sudra went away, another guest arrived, surrounded by dogs, and said, "O King, I and my company of dogs are very hungry. Please give us something to eat." With great respect, King Rantidev offered the balance of the food to the dogs and the master of the dogs who had come as guests. The king offered them all respects and obeisances. Thereafter, only the drinking water remained, and there was only enough to satisfy one person. But when the king was just about to drink it, a chandral appeared and said, "O king, although I am low-born, kindly give me some drinking water." Aggrieved at hearing the pitiful words of the poor, fatigued chandala, Maharaj Rantideva spoke the following nectarian words: "I do not pray to the Supreme Personality of Godhead for the eight perfections of mystic yoga, nor for salvation from repeated birth and death. I want only to stay among all the living entities and suffer all distresses on their behalf so that they may be freed from suffering." Paradukha Dukhi. Means a Vaishnava is very much aggrieved by the sufferings of others. "By offering my water to maintain the life of this poor Chandala who is struggling to live, I have been freed from all hunger, thirst, fatigue, trembling of the body, moroseness, distress, lamentation, and illusion." That's interesting, isn't it? That by going without, he was freed from the distress of, you know, feeling hunger and what have you. He rose above it. Having spoken thus, King Rantidev, although on the verge of death because of thirst, gave his own portion of water to the Chandala without hesitation, for the king was naturally very kind and sober. Demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, who can satisfy all materially ambitious men by giving them the rewards they desire, then manifested their own identities before King Rantidev, for it was they who had presented themselves as the Brahmana, Sudra, Chandala, and so on. King Rantidev had no ambition to enjoy material benefits from the demigods. He offered them obeisances, but because he was factually attached to Lord Vishnu Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he fixed his mind on Lord Vishnu's lotus feet. O Maharaj Prigat, because King Rantideva was a pure devotee, always Krishna conscious and free from all material desires, the Lord's illusory energy, Maya, could not exhibit herself before him. On the contrary, for him, Maya entirely vanished, exactly like a dream. All those who follow the principles of King Rantideva were totally favoured by his mercy and became pure devotees attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan. Thus they all became the best of yogis. From Garga, so we've heard about one of these five sons. That was the five sons of Manu. So from Nara we went to Sankriti and Rantidev. Now we're going to hear another one of the five sons, Garga. From Garga came a son named Shini, and his son was Gagya. Although Gagya was a Kshatriya, there came from him a generation of Brahmanas. From Mahavirya, so this is another line, another one of the sons, came the son named Duritakshaya, whose sons were Chayuruni, Kavi, Pushkaruni. Although these sons of Duritakshaya took birth in the dynasty of Kshatriyas, they too attained the position of Brahmanas. Brihachatra, so there's another one of the sons, had a son named Hashti, who established the city of Hastinapur, now New Delhi. So that Hastinapur goes way back, doesn't it? From King Hashti came three sons named, three sons named Ajamita, Dramida, and Puramida. The descendants of Ajamita, headed by Priyamida, all achieved the positions of Brahmanas. From Ajamita came a son named Brihadishu. From Brihadishu came a son named Brihadanu. From Brihadanu, a son named Brihatkaya. And from Brihatkaya, a son named Jayadratha. The son of Jayadratha was Vishuddha. The son of son was Shainajit. The son of Shainajit was Ruchisrava, Dridadanu, Kasya, and Vatsa. The son of Ruchisrava was Para, and the sons of Para were Prithushena and Nipa. Nipa had 100 sons. King Nipa had a son named Brihadmadatta through the womb of his wife Kritvi, who was the daughter of Shuka. And Brahmadatta, who was a great yogi, begot a son named Visvakshana through the womb of his wife Sarasvati. So in this line, it is mentioned in this purport regarding Shuka that this is a different one. The Shuka mentioned here is different from the Shukadeva Goswami, who spoke Bhagavatam. So, the son of Vyasadeva is described like this from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. There it is said that Vyasadeva maintained the daughter of Jabali as his wife, and after they performed penances together for many years, he placed his seed in her womb. The child remained in the womb of his mother for 12 years. And when the father asked the son to come out, the son replied that he would not come out unless he were completely liberated from the influence of Maya. Vyasadeva then assured the child that he would not be influenced by Maya, but the child did not believe his father, for the father was still attached to his wife and children. Vyasadeva then went to Dwarka and informed the personality of Godhead about his problem, and the personality of Godhead, at Vyasadeva's request, went to Vyasadeva's cottage, where he assured the child in the womb that he would not be influenced by Maya. Thus assured, the child came out, but he immediately went away as a Paribrajaka Acharya. When the father was very much aggrieved, began to follow the saintly boy, Sukadeva Goswami, the boy created a duplicate Sukadeva, who later entered family life. Therefore, the Sukakanya, or daughter of Sukadeva, mentioned in this verse, is the daughter of the duplicate or imitation Sukadeva. The original Sukadeva is a lifelong Brahmachari. So, following the instructions of the great sage, Jayagisabhya Visvakshina compiled an elaborate description of the mystic yoga system. From Visvakshina, Udakshina was born, and from Udakshina, Balata, all these sons are known as the descendants of Brihadishu. And then we go to the son of Vimitha was Yavanara, whose son was Kritiman. The son of Kritiman was well known as Satyadritta. From Satyadritta came a son named Didanema, Drinanemi, who became the father of Supashva. From Supashva came a son named Sumati, from Sumati came Sanatiman, and from Sanatiman came Kriti, who achieved mystic power from Brahma and taught six samhitas of the Prachaya Sharma verses of the Sama Veda. The son of Kriti was Nipa, the son of Nipa, Ugrayuddha, the son of Ugrayuddha was Shema, the son of Shema was Savira, and the son of Savira, Ripunujaya. From Ripunujaya came a son named Bahurata, Purumida, was sonless. And Ajamita had a son named Nila by his wife known as Nalini. The son of Nila was Shanti. The son of Shanti was Shushanti. The son of Shushanti was Puruja. And the son of Puruja was Arka. From Arka came Bharmyasva. And from Bharmyasva came five sons, Budgila, Yavanara, Brihadvishva, Kampila, and Sanjaya. Bhamishva prayed to his sons, "O my sons, please take charge of my five states, for you are quite competent to do so." Thus his five sons were known as the Panchalas. From Mudgala came a dynasty of Brahmanas known as Modgala. Mudgala, the son of Bhamyasva, had twin children, one male and the other female. The male child was known as Devadasa and the female child was known Ahalya. From the womb of Ahalya, by the semen of her husband Gautama, came a son named Satananda. The son of Satananda was Satchadriti, who was expert in archery, and the son of Satchadriti was Sharadvan. When Sharadvan met Urvasi, he discharged semen, which fell on a clump of Sara grass. From this semen were born two all-auspicious babies, one male and the other female. While Maharaj Santanu was on a hunting excursion, he saw the male and female children lying in the forest, and out of compassion he took them home. Consequently, the male child was known as Kripa and the female child was named Kripi. Kripa later became the wife of Dronacharya. And next time we meet, we'll hear about the descendants of Ajamita. So we're down at... Well, we're almost there.
It's preparing us.
Yes, because we're in the line of Puru, and Puru brings us down into the line of Guru. let's see. Where's that man? Anyway, how's it preparing us?
Yes. So it is preparing us to understand the personality of Godhead and understanding the sexual position. That's but what we're reading now.
Right, because what we'll hear is Krishna appeared in this line, and he was especially, merciful to Yadu. And so, when Krishna appears, he appears in the family line of, it's a great privilege for Krishna to appear in someone's family. I'd love to have Krishna appear in my family, but I don't think it's going to happen. And, although, when my spiritual master gave us the Govardhan Shila, he said, this will be your son. But... we're understanding. So we're hearing about these great personalities. Krishna appeared in this line, So their qualifications, their spiritual qualifications, and some of them in particular, even outshining those that we can barely, you know, understand their greatness. Krishna appeared. So it's not an ordinary line of persons. So this helps us to understand, you know, Krishna's birth is really favouring some of the most exalted persons that are known within the universe. You know, especially in the devotional line. So it's not ordinary even in that respect. Many of those persons, of course, coming in his line, so Krishna quite often refers to Arjuna as O son of Bharat. So even in Krishna's time, and Bharat goes way, way back, their name and glory just, it never stops. The glories of these personalities just never stops. And even in Arjuna's time, you know, Bharat, who's thousands, perhaps millions of years back, is to remind Arjuna of his ancestry that, you know, I've appeared in this line of these great personalities, Arjuna. You have taken birth in this line. You are a great personality. They are a great personality, and this is why I'm here with you today. So, it helps us to understand that in every respect, Krishna's appearance is not an ordinary appearance. This whole family line is not an ordinary family line. You know, you try and find another family that you can sit and talk. You can't find another family like this. You know, this is unique, actually, in the universe. Such glorious personalities. So, in the most exalted personalities, Krishna appeared in their line, and amongst them, there are some devotees who are so dear to Krishna that, you know, particularly he wanted to glorify them. Particularly, this person is famous even in the line of such great personalities, and. Therefore, even Krishna's relationship with Arjuna is not an ordinary cousin's. You know? Krishna has appeared in the line of these great personalities, and Arjuna has actually come down in line, and they're connected, these two great lines from Puru and Kuru, Yadu and Puru, right, coming on that, those two great lines coming down, they're connected because Kunti, who's coming in the Yadu dynasty, married Pandu, who's coming in the Puru dynasty. So, through the connection of Kunti, Arjuna is related to all of these personalities going back at that. So, you know, through Arjuna, Krishna connects, becomes the glory of all those personalities in both lines. So, and they all become glorified, and they all become glorified that in the family of such persons, the Lord appears and shows his mercy for their wonderful, you know, example and spirituality. So there's nothing ordinary about everything is transcendental. And of course, amongst those personalities, we are here in their pastimes. And those pastimes themselves are purifying us for understanding Krishna consciousness and purifying us of material desires. And, we understand that to associate with Krishna, one has to have, you know, to associate with the Supreme Pure, we actually have to become completely pure. So many different things. All right, leave it there. We will see you next week. And of course, we're up to chapter 22. Well, we've only got, there's a lot of dynasties and what have you. My goodness, it'd be highly unlikely that we wouldn't finish the whole thing next week. So, could be a big week, yes. And that's what I'm planning on doing. So, get here early, 2:00. Be liberal, get here 1:55. And we'll see if we can finish that. Okay, Jai, Hare Krishna.
Question, because next class I won't be able to come.
Right.